Well, good morning and welcome back to the Sundance Reel on KPCW. We are broadcasting live from Whole Foods this morning. And of course, the show is sponsored by Whole Foods and Mark Miller Subaru. I'm Nell Larson. I'm here with John Wells. And joining us for the next few minutes is Debbie LaBelle, who's the Metro Marketing Team Leader here at Whole Foods. So Debbie, tell us a little bit about your role. What does Metro Marketing Team Leader mean?
It means a lot. No, I do a lot of events locally at our stores and then outside our stores as well. I do our social media. I do a little bit of marketing in store as well. And I pretty much wear all the marketing hats.
And you get to be really involved in the fun community giving programs
yes,
that Whole Foods has.
Totally forgot to mention that. Community giving is actually about a quarter of my job. So I partner with our local nonprofits to put on events and 5% days and bag donations.
And today, of course, is KPCW's 5% day here at Whole Foods.
Correct. We're so excited.
Where 5% of sales, in fact, go to the nonprofit, correct?
Yes, it's a very big day, and it's very easy to support KPCW by just coming in and shopping what you would do anyway.
Yeah, and it's not just during the time we're having a program from 9 to 11. It's all day. So that goes until what time tonight?
Correct, till 10 p.m. tonight.
Oh,
so
I
you
love
can
it.
Shop late.
Debbie, tell us about the importance of local suppliers, local farmers, local providers
sure.
to Whole Foods here in Park City.
Yes, one of our favorite things that we get to do at Whole Foods is to work with local food artisans and farmers to bring them into the store as our vendors. And we currently work with about 80 local vendors. And what we really appreciate is bringing in what we call hyper-local. And that means made in Park City for us here. And so we do have quite a few hyper-local vendors. We just brought in Jaffel's Toasted Pockets this week, in fact.
And we're tasting them right now.
We are. They are delicious.
Literally right now.
Yeah. So we have about, I would say, maybe six hyper-local vendors right now. Like Park City Brewery is a good example. Park City Roasters, Ritual Chocolate, Leafy Mama Chocolate, and Hee Haw Pickles.
And what is a food provider? What process do they have to go through to be accepted into a Whole Foods store?
Sure. It is quite a process. We first have to meet with them and make sure that their food does not contain any of our forbidden ingredients. There are hundreds of forbidden ingredients. Just as a basic, things like no artificial colors, flavors, sweeteners, no high fructose corn syrup, nitrites, things like that. So it's quite a process. So we have to make sure that their food is clean and suits Whole Foods standards first, and then they go through a process for becoming a vendor.
The footprint of the new store across the street, which will be open sometime, I believe, in October, is considerably larger than this store. Tell us what people can expect to find in the new store that maybe is not here in this store.
Correct. So it's roughly double the size of our current Whole Foods Park City store. And so we're just going to really be able to better serve this community with some different food venues. We'll have a juice bar, which we haven't had before. We're very excited about that. We'll have a tap room with local beer on tap and kind of like a bar situation. And we will have a better expanded coffee bar. And a lot of our departments will be expanded, like our cheese will be fully expanded. And then we'll have a ton of prepared food venues. That's probably the biggest difference between the old store and the new store is we'll have different food options, like maybe a noodle bowl option and different things like that. We're trying to work with local vendors now to bring them in to help us with that.
So for guys that don't like to shop, they could come in and have a beer now.
There you go. This
exactly.
is sounding nice.
It's starting to work.
Very convenient.
Well, we've got just a couple more minutes, and I know that we've talked about the local providers and the community giving. Whole Foods has a whole array of environmental programs beyond that. Do you want to just take a minute to give an overview of a few of the other things you do?
Sure. So we have a program called Your Change Creates Change to encourage our customers to bring in their reusable bags. We really want to just use existing bags and not paper bags, if at all possible. So we basically assign one nonprofit per quarter to be the recipient of our bag donation program, and that happens each quarter. So that's one of our bigger environmental efforts. And then, of course, we have a lot of recycling programs within our stores. We even recycle glass. So
that's across the board. There's a lot going on at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
So next year at this time, we'll be broadcasting from the new location.
From the new location.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Oh, that's going to be exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very exciting. So we are looking at mid-October 2017 to be in our new store location.
Roger Crawford wants his own personal internet connection.
I got that request.
Yeah.
I'm submitting it.
And I think you mentioned this earlier. This is, of the five stores that you work with, this is physically one of the smaller stores, but it is the most, it does the most sales.
Correct. Yes. We have a very loyal community here in Park City, and then we also have a lot of people coming in town for Sundance and skiing and whatnot. So this is a big store in our Utah community, and our new store is going to be our flagship mountain store in the country.
Ooh.
Yes.
Sounds exciting.
Very exciting designation.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have to wrap up and get our next film on air. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us again this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Debbie LaBelle, the Whole Foods Metro Marketing Team Leader. Next up, we'll be speaking with the director and producer of Plastic China. And I think they're coming in to sit down right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, we'll play a little bit of music and do our little transition.
Fantastic.
And we'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us.
Hanley's Farmers Insurance. Our agency has been a longtime supporter of KPCW. Hanley's Farmers provides life, health, auto, commercial, home, motorcycle, and financial services. I can be found at 6443 North Business Loop Road, number K in the Silver Creek Commons, north of Home Depot.
Upcoming filmmakers are in Park City for the 2017 Sundance Film Festival, and you can find out all about their newest projects. Tune into KPCW each weekday morning between 9 and 10 for the Sundance Reel and the first weekend of the festival from 8 to 10 to hear from filmmakers, producers, and actors. That's the Sundance Reel through January 27th, right here on KPCW or online at kpcw.org.
The Sundance Reel is sponsored in part by Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Hospital. We're part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System and a proud supporter of KPCW. In addition to supporting our community radio station, Park City Hospital is also proud to support the athletes and coaches of the United States Ski and Snowboard Association. As one of the USSA's official medical providers, we provide orthopedic surgery, physical therapy, imaging services, holistic health, and more to some of the world's most celebrated athletes. Park City Hospital and the USSA. Now that's an unbeatable team.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Nell Larson, and I'm here with John Wells. And next we're speaking with the creators of the film Plastic China. This is a documentary, of course, debuting at Sundance this year. We're speaking with director Juliang Wang and producer Ruby Chen. And Ruby will also be translating for us this morning. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. We're very delighted to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So our first question is, what was your, you know, this film looks at a family that's living and working amongst plastic recycling, and they're trying to make their living this way in order to send their daughter back to school. What was your motivation for choosing this film topic?
动机.
Okay. 我们每个人对垃圾看似很熟悉，其实很陌生。
We produce garbages every day. We seem to be really familiar, but in fact, we are quite, unfamiliar with what's going on after we dump it away.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. As somebody who thinks of myself as pretty environmentally aware, who recycles everything I can, you don't think of the details of how that's happening. Why don't you give us a brief overview of the film and the story it tells?
简单介绍一下影片。影片讲述的是在中国的一家回收工厂里面工人和老板两家人的故事。
The film talks about two families who lives and works in a small, very primitive workshops that recycles plastic waste. And those wastes are, in fact, imported from developed countries, such as United States, Europe, and Japan, Korea, even.
So this isn't the byproduct of products that are imported. This is actual waste that is imported?
It's you would not believe that these are things you thought that you recycled. You dump them into the recycle bin, and then, you know, the afterlife of that is that there's, of course, companies processing them, you know, sorting them out, and then there are some unsorted parts. You know, there's all mingled with, like, plastic covers of everything, you know, containers, you know, with ice cream in it and so on. You see all these things, you know, in the film.
The environment is really a sea of waste. You see it everywhere. And with all this isolating, toxic atmosphere, the movie has an optimism to it. Can you talk about that?
I would just speak on behalf of the director, and then the director can chip in later. I think when the director started this in 2011, the research was because after his last film, which was called Beijing Besieged by Waste, that film actually tracks the waste from his home to the garbage field and figuring out how horrible the situation was. It was basically surrounding the whole Beijing city. You see all these improperly handled waste, garbage fields. Through his film, that situation was changed because all the media coverage inside China, people getting really, much more aware of the issue. The government actually has spent, billions of RMB and trying to solve the problem. And so it at least has partially been corrected. And so he had the opportunity to visit, screen the films and discuss with institutions, universities, professors, and so on in the States. He then got an opportunity to meet some people who are literally doing the plastic recycle. And then he realized that there were these facts as the backdrop of our film Plastic China, where the things were packed into container as, all the plastic waste. And then Chinese business people, they are very good business people, of course, so they bought these waste, in a very low price, like $9 per ton, and then imported them inside into China. Not saying China doesn't have proper regulations to basically regulate the situation, but you know how sneaky businessmen sometimes could be. And so they managed to get all those stuff into China. Literally nowadays, when the film was done a couple of years ago, there were like more than 15,000 workshops, as we've seen in the film. There are proper ones that are like, good as showcase, but there are these ones that are, you could argue, money-wise, it like seems to be really economically reasonable. But of course, the price is, of course, the pollution, environmental. And those were the whole backdrops of why the director wanted to do the film. So the film, as you mentioned, John, that there is seems to be a optimistic side of this is because we strongly believe, I as the producer and Julian as the director, we strongly believe that basically human beings, we have our strength and we have our weakness. And people in this situation, they couldn't find better ways to make a living, then they just go for the easiest way, and which is the backdrop. Then the kids in there, despite the, hazard situation, they still find their ways of make fun, among themselves. They play with the garbage. They make creative things. As you see, Ije, the little girl, was able to manage to produce her own computer, you know, from the waste. And we strongly believe that people wanted to have better life. And they work really hard trying to get some more money so that they can send their kids to school. The boss, of course, wanted to buy his new car. But that's something that, you know, it's a human weakness in terms of a material desire. That's the side of the, you know, the ugly and the dangerous situation. Yeah.
The car was $13,000. It required a $6,500 down payment. He didn't have the down payment, and he wouldn't be able to make the payments. It was a tough situation.
It was, but you see that how hard he was working.
Yeah.
He almost worked like, you know, 14, 16 hours a day, standing there the whole time, just trying to cranking out a recycled, you know, cheaper plastic resin, the materials, for producing more cheaper stuff that, you know, China can export to the world. So, in fact, if you think about this whole thing, at the backdrop of this is that we, as consumers, we do have our own responsibility. And that's, you know, one of the points as both the director and I myself, we felt like we wanted to communicate with the audience or whoever, you know, watching the film that, yes, the problem is very serious. People didn't meant to do this, you know, on a malicious intention, but rather it's really the reality. And when we do not like the reality that we're seeing, we have to change it. And the way, the best way, in our view, to change things in China is not to, you know, finger pointing, this is somebody's fault, or finger pointing, this is which government's fault. In fact, under the globalization situation, we are all the victims of the convenience, the cheaper stuff that we're able to get, and also the price that we're paying for, you know, pollution and these other problems. So one of the calls if we could make through the film, honestly, is trying to let people see how these two families are trying their best to make a good living while, you know, really the problem, it's out of their own hands. And we as consumers, we rethink about, do we really need that extra cup of plastic stuff, that disposable container that mm-hmm. we're getting? And if we could all aim to use less plastic, mm-hmm. And I think the film has some contribution.
It absolutely does. I mean, I have to say, after watching it, I think about every single thing I pick up, it was a great reminder of where those things go and how they end up. You mentioned those two families doing the best that they can in the circumstances they have. And I'm curious as to how they came to be recycling. One of the families was from a much more rural area and I think had lived on a farm. Is this, but now they're living in, you know, a city with 15,000 of these tiny recycling shops. Why are people making that change? And is that a broad scale that you're seeing, or is that just a specific case?
Right. It's a very good question because, as you all know, China is big. It's really, you know, I think the land itself is really big. And also there's a huge diversity, if you want. More than 92% people are Han population. That's what we always know as Chinese. And then there are minorities. In the Chinese definition, these are, you know, approximately 7 to 8% minorities are basically distributed, you know, across China, and there are like, you know, 52 different ethnics, including the Mongolians, the Tibetan, you know, the Yi minority, the Miao minority, etc. So this family, with Ije, the girl, and the several brothers, they are the Yi ethnics. So they came from, you know, 2,000 miles away in the mountain area of Sichuan. And that is really very mountain, and the land in mountain is not really rich, as you can see here in Park City. So they weren't able to make enough money for sustaining the whole family. So the father decides to take the family, but they're also very family-oriented. So they take the whole family to the coastal places in the film, which is in the Shandong province, and then make a living there. And of course, you have people who are same e-minority work in other workshops, and that's the in China it's a huge phenomenon of so-called migration workers. People basically they go where the money is or where they think the money is.
I'm curious, has the film been screened for Chinese people or government officials?
The film has been screened outside of China thus far. We haven't done any official screening inside China. But the director, during his research stage, had done a short sort of like a news piece on it. And that has some circulation back in 2014. It was a short one, but talks about mostly about the industry. So it's a different thing. But yes, people are aware, if that's your intention of the question.
Well, I wanted to know if it hadn't been screened extensively in China yet, what is your anticipated reaction by Chinese people at large? And also, would this be embarrassing to the government?
I think the Chinese, we have showed it. First of all, we have did some private screenings inside our studio where we have invited friends and advisors to watch the films. They watched it and they were all amazed by how bad the situation seems to be and believe that we need to do something. The media also understand that there's this film coming to Sundance and so on, so they obviously tried to look into this. So there were some private screening for three medias, important ones in China, and then they had write about this already. And basically, I think people who had read the article believe that, this is an important film inside China, and they want to see it. But we haven't done any official screening in China. And we plan to do this after maybe a few festivals.
I was just going to ask, what are your plans when you go back? Do you anticipate screening the film around the country like you did with the last documentary, things like that?
Yeah. We will... There are a few festivals line up already. We will disclose later because the fact that we are coming to Sundance is very exciting, and we have many, many interest. We have to schedule the director's time so that he can try to go to as many as we could. And then we will have to show this back in China, maybe starting with a smaller circle. As John asked the question, would the government be embarrassed? We obviously do not want to embarrass anyone. Instead, we want people to know that there are problems, and please, let's face it, and let's together find solution, to make it better. As the result of his last film, I think that's the positive attitude that we're having. And we're too chicken to finger point to anyone because in China, it doesn't create any real impact if you try to be on the other side of the table. The best thing is to bring everybody on board and feeling that we are all obligated to solve the problem.
It's kind of similar to the last movie we talked about where it's not just a black and white clear issue. There are gray areas, and it's a complex issue. And so I understand exactly what you're saying. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm curious as to how you found the two families that you featured. Why did you decide on this specific recycling shop? There are many ethnic people in that area, so trying to locate the E people, the workers, is not difficult.
Because there are too many people like this, too many people.
In fact, the issue why we see them as very unique, in fact, they are not that unique, if you want. Actually, many of these migrant workers, they suffer similarly. So this is really a common family there in that area. It's not such a special, unique family. It's basically a very common problem, you know. So we're not just sampling the most extreme case.
Right.
We're really representing these people and speak for them.
And how did you two build the partnership that you have on this film?
Right.
他说我们俩怎么开始这个合作的，你要不要先说两句？我仅仅是一个作者，可能更多的在有电影操作上我没有经验，所以可能Ruby晨更适合去做这些事情。
Yeah, the director just humbly saying that he is just a author, and he doesn't understand, you know, how to make a film, the storytelling that can really communicate with the a larger international audience, in addition, you know, of course, the Chinese audience. And then he thinks Ruby Chen, myself, knows a little bit better. And just by the way, maybe I didn't talk about this, but I co-funded a nonprofit foundation called CNEX Foundation. We funded the foundation in Hong Kong. In the past 10 years, we have been supporting independent Chinese documentary films. Every year we support 10 films, and so the mandate was for us to support 100 films over 10 years. That really depicts the contemporary Chinese society and the development in the Chinese society. And I think we somehow we're about to reach the goal, because this is the 10th anniversary year of CNEX. And so that's why Julian get to know me. Through the CNEX workshops, we cultivate filmmakers in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. If you understand the political situation there, we're doing this. We call it as a Greater China Initiative. Basically, we try to communicate, despite all the differences and all the seemingly argument between China and Taiwan, we try to bring everybody together through documentary films. That depicts the real situation, the reality of people's life there.
Well, that sounds incredible. Amazing mission. We're so lucky to speak with you both today. Thanks very much for joining us. That was Juyang Wang and Ruby Chen.
Our pleasure.
With the film Plastic China. Thank you so much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we believe Jesse Beshear and Charlie Hoxie will be here from the film Harat. And so stay with us. We'll be back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Amy Hayes.
And I'm Diamond Dave.
And I'm DJ Mike. We're part of the KPCW Air Force. You know, volunteer DJs.
Have you ever thought of a career in broadcasting, serving your community, and volunteering as a KPCW DJ? If so, KPCW wants you.
We'll train you.
Show you the ropes.
And get you on the air just like that.
For more information, email Dave at kpcw.org or just call the station, 435-649-9004.
This is Danny Warner, owner of Chateau Recovery, and proud to sponsor The Mountain Life on KPCW. Chateau Recovery provides comprehensive and holistic care to create direction and focus for adults looking for an empowering and effective recovery experience. Information available at 866-808-4160 or chateaurecovery.com. Addiction is a disease. Recovery is a choice.
Of cancers affecting both men and women, colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States. But it doesn't have to be. I'm Dr. Rick Craig, gastroenterologist at University of Utah Healthcare's Redstone Clinic. Colon cancer is preventable with early screening. If you are 50 or older, get screened. For more information, visit redstone.uofuhealth.org. University of Utah Healthcare is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel on KPCW. I'm John Wells with Nell Larson. We're broadcasting live from Whole Foods in Redstone. Joining us now, director Jesse Beshear and Charlie Hoxie, editor for the short film Harat. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Harat.
Harat. Okay, great. Welcome to the to the Sundance Reel.
Thanks so much for having us.
This is our first full day of Sundance. We'll be going until the 29th. It's the very beginning right now. It's going to be a lot of fun. You all excited?
Oh, absolutely. So excited.
Okay, great. So let me ask you this. In the mighty kingdom of Sundance, and I looked everywhere, there's only one sentence that describes your film. I'm going to read it now. One man's nightly ritual brings solace to the lovelorn of Harar. Now, this is a family program. I'm almost afraid to ask you what this film's about. So carefully take us through what this film's all about.
Sure. So Harat is the century-old ritual that has been taking place every night in Harar, of bonding with hyenas and feeding hyenas. So in the 19th century, at some point, there was a big famine, and starving hyenas started to storm in the city and attack people and their livestock. So the elders and the wise men, they got together, they convened to find a solution. And the solution they came up with was feeding hyenas at night and calm their hunger. So that started a tradition. Now, that tradition died off at some point. And then one farmer picked up that tradition again, and that was in the 60s, and that is the principal subject of Harat. So,
And we're talking about Eastern Ethiopia here, to place it. Yeah.
In Harar.
And what is in it for the farmer? Is there good karma that comes back? I mean, what is the reason that he does this, besides, of course, feeding the hyenas?
Of course. Well, you know, as I said a long time ago, it was to stave away hunger. For him, however, it is a nightly communion that he has with hyenas. It's a very personal thing. And every night he treks outside of the ancient walled city of Harar to meet these hyenas, which he calls by their names, and they start coming over to him. And he not only feeds them, he plays with them. He lulls them. He serenades them. And that is a mesmerizing thing. And I grew up in Harar. And this is pre-TV and this and that. And this is one thing that we all do. If you, at nighttime, want to do something, you go and chill with Abba Yusuf. So these are memories that I have that have always stayed in my mind and that have mesmerized me. So I wanted to shoot that and share it.
Well, I was going to ask, how did you find this man, this gem, you know? And it sounds like it's something that you grew up watching. Is this a tradition that you think will, you know, extend beyond this one person, or is it just a very personal experience for him?
Well, it was a personal experience for him, and now he, there are other people that are starting his son. You know, since childhood, his son has been trekking with him to the outskirts of the walled city to feed these hyenas. They literally pack about at least 7 kilos of camel meat, and they go over there and they sit there and that's what they do. And so now there are a couple of more younger generation, but there are probably two or three. It's pretty much a dying tradition, and I wanted to capture it through the person that started it.
And this can't be an inexpensive proposition, 16, 17, 18 pounds of camel meat every night.
Well, now, because people started hearing about this, so everyone that goes to Harar, that's one thing they want to go and see. So now it has become a little bit of, if you go at night, you see a lot of foreigners that are coming over to see, and they have, they donate, you know, a very minimal, you know, amount that pretty much, you know, is for the meat. And he has been able to sustain a big family, you know, and put his son through school and so forth through this.
That's just incredible. Living in a walled city, is this a way to kind of like commune with nature and the wilderness, or is it more about the hedonism themselves? What's the motivation?
So basically, will be
his motivation. Well, I mean, there are many stories around how it all started. You know, there are some that say it's through his uncle that he started, through his father, that one day he was. Feeding them to stave from his livestock. But regardless of what the genesis is, the fact is, you know, for me, the most important thing is that I see this relationship, a very unique relationship of a man with wild hyenas, wild spotted hyenas. I mean, these hyenas are huge, you know, to be around them. I mean, I'm very comfortable because, you know, since he's so comfortable around them and he wants to kiss them and everything, you know, but these are wild beasts. And so for me to see the existence of that type of relationship of that a man can have, it's a beautiful thing. It extends beyond. And for me, you know, the film, it's a little bit like a prayer. You know, it's a little bit like a lullaby.
How big are these cats?
They're huge. They weigh anywhere from 180 pounds and up.
Okay.
All right. They're big.
And they're pack animals, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the whole pack shows up, and he knows he names them all. He knows them all.
He knows them all. Not only that, he knows their generations.
Okay.
And then he goes like, oh, okay, look, this is the new one that was born. You know, look at the newborn. Oh, you know, that one. He knows the ones that are not coming anymore, so the ones that are dead. So he can name them, you know, for you. And literally when he's feeding them, he's calling them, each of them, by their name.
Yeah.
And they come to him. And, yeah.
It sounds fascinating, Nell, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I want to see this.
Yeah, I do too. And this is a short. How long is this film?
This is 6 minutes and 39 seconds.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And when will people have the opportunity to see it?
Well, we're screening today at the Mountain Resort. Tomorrow, the 21st, at the Redstone Cinema One.
Right around the corner from us here.
Yeah. Yes. At 9:30 p.m.
At 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday, the 25th, at 9 p.m. at the Broadway Center Cinema.
In Salt Lake City, right?
Yeah. And then on Saturday, which is our last screening, at the Holiday Village at 7 p.m.
Nell, did you see how quick Charlie got that schedule out? He must be the editor. He is definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got the A game going. How did you guys get together?
We were introduced through a mutual friend who's also from Ethiopia and who I met when I traveled in Ethiopia before meeting Jessica. So I actually got a chance to see Abba Yusuf do his thing. From a different perspective, and so it was a lot of fun to meet Jessica and see all this amazing footage that she had shot, and she needed help editing, and we put it together, and here we are.
Okay, and what most surprised you when you were filming this? Was there anything that, I mean, you had an expectation of what you wanted your product to look like? What surprised you during the process?
He surprised me. He surprised me because I had told him the night before that, you know, if we could shoot, and he said, yes, come on over. And it's as if he's been doing this all his life. You know, he was just so focused on what he does that, you know, no camera, no nothing fazed him. And so that was beautiful to see. And also the hyenas. The hyenas themselves, they were not afraid. They're not afraid of me at all. It was a very small crew. It was just me and one more person. So we had our equipment around. We had to chase the hyenas because they kept taking our equipment away, you know. And just the beauty of it and how it translates into film.
Jesse Beshear, who is the director, Charlie Hoxie, who is the editor. The film is titled Harat, and it is a short. We just went through the schedule, about a century-old practice of feeding hyenas in the evening in Ethiopia, in the walled city of Harat. Sounds fascinating. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having us.
Best of luck, and really enjoy your time while you're here.
Thank you. We will.
Okay, great. Nell and I are going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to be talking with the folks from the film Rumble, the Indian rock. the world. We'll be speaking with the director, Catherine Bainbridge, and also speaking with Ernest Webb. You're listening to KPCW. This is the Sundance Channel live at Whole Foods. Stay with us.
Alpine touring skis, snowshoes, and fat tire bike.
Supported by Utah Rugs on Highland Drive in Salt Lake City. UtahRugs.com. KPCW. Now more than ever, we've got your Wasatch back. Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, E-S-C-O. Some call Don Quixote a fool. Others call him a lunatic. But in Man of La Mancha, you might end up calling him an inspiration as you follow the unlikely journey of a man who dreams the impossible dream of a better world all around him. Believe in his dream with Utah Opera's rousing performance of Man of La Mancha, January 21st through the 29th at Capitol Theater. For tickets, visit utahopera.org.
This is Patrick Fannin with Switchback Sports, Park City's sporting goods consignment shop and sponsor of Sports Talk on KPCW. Switchback Sports carries a selection of new and gently used summer and winter gear from bikes to skis for the whole family. Store information at 615-1555 or on the web at switchbacksportspc.com.
Well, it's time to say good morning and welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Nell Larson, here with John Wells. And here for our next interview are the creators of the film Rumble, The Indians Who Rock the World. This is a deeply insightful film that describes how some of our most popular and treasured artists and songs found their inspiration in ancient Native melodies that were infused with a desire to resist. And so with that, welcome to the show to the director of the film, Catherine Bainbridge, and the producer, Ernest Webb.
Thank you.
And you also happen to be a married couple as well.
Yes.
Partners in work and in life.
Partners in crime.
Wonderful. Well, let's start with this. What was your motivation to make this specific film?
There was an exhibit, a museum exhibit, in Washington, D.C. that was created by two people. One guy named Stevie Salas, who is a rock star in his own right, who played with Rod Stewart and with Mick Jagger when he went solo, amazing guitarist, who collaborated with another indigenous person named Tim Johnson, who is Mohawk from Six Nations and was head of the museum for the National Museum for the American Indian, the Smithsonian. The two of them came together and said, nobody knows about the indigenous influence on rock and roll, and there is one. And so they put together this small museum exhibit. Well, it was one of the most popular exhibits that Smithsonian ever had. So then they did it in New York. And then they said, we better make a documentary. And so they came to us, and that's how it started.
Well, take a minute and just shine a light on this whole story and what people don't know and the importance of the indigenous influence in American and world music.
So we all know that there is an African-American influence on music. We talk about it all the time, you know, blues, jazz, and we talk about a European influence on it as well. You know, everyone knows that the white people also were in there, you know what I mean? What we don't know is there is actually a profound indigenous influence on American music, and we don't know about it. And the film tells you why, and you learn, you see it, and you feel it, and you actually hear it in the music. And some of the most, the songs that we know so well.
Oh. We're all right over here.
Live radio and adventure.
It has an indigenous influence. And so, for instance, there's an amazing guitarist named Link Ray. And we have some of the greatest musicians in the world who came and did the film with us, who were interviewed for the film, like Slash, like Iggy Pop, like Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys.
Of course.
Marky Ramone. It's Martin Scorsese, who's not a musician, but who is someone who really follows culture.
And who has also pushed music forward in this country with his wonderful film.
Yeah, like No Direction Home about Bob Dylan, which is
Last Waltz.
Last Waltz,
yeah.
Which is also about Robbie Robertson, who is in the band, who was the guitarist for the band, but also the writer for the band, who most people don't know is Mohawk.
Yeah.
He's half Mohawk, half Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's all these artists who, the famous ones I just mentioned, were all came on the phone because they really wanted to talk about Link Wray. Link Wray is the grandfather of rock and roll, of punk, and of heavy metal. He invented the power chord and distortion. He was the first one that gave that tone that pointed away to the future. And he is unknown to all of us regular people, but all...
They've heard the song, but they don't know where it came from.
All the famous musicians know him. They all know about him, and we don't. And that was fascinating to us. Wait, this circle of musicians all know this history, and we know nothing about it. So that was the inspiration to really get in the film and figure out, okay, what's going on here?
It would be fascinating to hear a couple of chops from Link Wray and then switch to, and maybe you do this in the film, to Hendrix, who, of course, was a wizard at using in power chords and also in using feedback and those sorts of things. Let's talk about Jimi.
Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix is part Cherokee. Jimi Hendrix's grandmother was raised on a reservation. Raised on a reservation, and his grandmother was raised on a reservation. She became a vaudeville performer. She wore...
She had a trunk full of funky clothes.
Yeah, like velvets and feathers and fringe, native things and vaudeville things. And Jimi spent all his summers with her. And he would practice his little ukulele and guitars in the attic, trying on all those clothes, because she was a real performer. And you can see that in what he represented. He represented African American, he represented indigenous, and he represented also European. He was part Scottish.
I think what we also have to remember here is that we don't want to take anything away from anybody. We're just adding to the story, you know. So I think that's one of the important points of this film as well.
Yeah, like a great jazz critic who was in the film told us, he said, look, African Americans are the driving force behind blues and jazz. There's no question about that. It's the African American experience in America. But that experience in America involved a lot of things.
So do you talk with any of the musicians themselves that brought this Native influence, you know, that grew up on the reservation? Or are you mostly talking to other musicians that are talking about those people's influence? You know what I mean?
We talk a lot to really famous musicians. There's a lot in the film, because we wanted, if Slash tells you that this guitarist is foundational to American rock and roll, Slash tells you Link Wray is foundational to rock and roll, you will believe him, as opposed to just, you know, a random person like ourselves. but there are many indigenous musicians in the film as well. Particularly a woman out of North Carolina, Tuscarora, named Apurife Crisoni, who is in a group called Eulalie. They're a woman singing group. And indigenous women, carried this cultural history, as women often do, along. Like they kept the oral tradition of the indigenous involvement in music and of indigenous music. So we talked to a lot of... We talk to a lot of indigenous people about the traditional music, when you hear the traditional music, and then you hear the influence in blues and jazz, and you'll hear it in the film. You will see, you will hear it. They actually show you, and you listen, and you go, okay, I got it. And lots of African American blues musicians talk about it as well, because they also know. The people in the know.
And one thing about the plantations down in the South is that there were a lot of Native women there too. And so you had the African men and the Native American women mixing together there. And so that's where the melting pot came from, with all the music influences and styles.
Now, Robbie Robertson was a tremendous, and still is, a tremendous musician. He also wrote most of the songs for the band. Great songwriter. But more than anything, he's a tremendous storyteller and a person who's principled in trying to talk about history. And so I can now kind of put the dots together, and I hadn't before. It's starting to take shape.
He talks about when he was young on the Six Nations Reservation, where he spent all his summers, that he would listen to the elders talking and storytelling. And that's a tradition that he saw in action, and it inspired him from a very young age that he wanted to be a storyteller. He kept saying, I want to get in with that crowd, because those were the people who were admired. The good storytellers were admired and given such respect in his culture. And that's why he wanted, he was from an early age inspired to be a great storyteller, and he chose music as the form that he would do it in.
Are any of these musicians going to be with you this week at Sundance?
Yes.
Okay, what do you got
yes.
there?
She says with a smile.
What do you got, Kathleen?
Well, does anyone know the Black Eyed Peas?
Of course.
So Taboo from the Black Eyed Peas is Shoshone.
Okay.
He is coming and will be at the premiere. He's also DJing for us in the evening at a party.
Oh, that's excellent.
And Ricky Medlock. Has anyone heard of the Lynyrd Skynyrd Band?
Of course.
Ricky Medlock is the guitarist. He's Blackfoot.
Okay.
And he's coming, and he has great storytelling about growing up in the South, because the South was African American, it was indigenous, and it was also, you know, poor Irish and Italians. Like, I mean, we were all there working on those I'm Irish. We were all there working on those plantations, and that part of our history is not known, and it's so important. If we're going to have a great future, we really got to understand our past. It's foundational, you know, to build a society. And we can see now with all the tribalism and, you know, fracturism going on, that we need to go back and understand. And so this movie's in part that. But through music.
Fantastic. Are there still tickets available to any of your screenings? Do you know?
Sold out.
Sold out. So you'll have to get on that e-wait list that John Wells is also on for a few films.
I would say, in addition to the e-list, you may just want to break in and go in illegally.
Yes. Can I just say one thing for those?
Is that okay to say that?
Yeah, can you say that on the air?
Can I just say one thing? I know we're wrapping up, but just the, because there are those tickets they put aside, and if you can get them, the theater experience is amazing, because the co-director is a huge DOP from Montreal. He does all the big feature films. His name's Alfonso Majorana. He does American geography, because, of course, music comes from the land, right? He does the north, south, east, and west of American geography that blows your mind. So if you have a chance to get in, the theatrical experience is amazing.
So break in.
So as JW suggested, right? Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Bainbridge and Ernest Webb talking to us about their film Rumble, The Indians Who Rocked the World. We can't wait to see this one, right, JW?
Absolutely. Yeah, sounds fascinating. We are music fans here at KPCW. We also wanted to take a minute and also, once again, we wanted to thank Whole Foods and also Roger Crawford, who is our engineer who put all this together with Joel, and Carolyn Murray, who is our producer.
That's right. Thanks to the whole team who put together today's show, as well as Mark Miller Subaru for sponsoring the Sundance Reel today, and Whole Foods, again, for their support, and the wonderful breakfast we're all taking advantage of right now next to the table.
We're going to go back for our final messages. If we have any time afterwards, we'll say goodbye after that. Roger, we'll send it back to you.
Hi, I'm Joe Simmons with the Park City High School. Stay in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during Morning News with Leslie Thatcher, and in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things Park City Miners athletics. The Minor Nation Report is brought to you in part by the Park City UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, U.S. Bank Park City, and Miller Orthodontics.
Local programming on KPCW is brought to you by a generous grant from Summit County RapTax. Recreation, Arts, and Parks Cultural Grant supports organizations that enrich the overall quality of life for residents throughout the county.
This is KPCW Park City, home of award-winning local news, great music, and useful information, especially this winter, traffic and weather. Stay tuned to KPCW, where we've got your Wasatch back.
We want to thank everyone for joining us this morning in the Sundance Reel on KPCW. And I've loved working with you.
Likewise. It's been a good week.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting week. We go to the 29th. If you love film, this is the place to be, isn't it, Nell?
Absolutely. Tune in to KPCW every morning.
I want to see all these films.
Me too. It's going to be a busy 10 days.
Okay. So, NPR National News is next. Everybody get outside. Have some fun. Go see some films.
Remember, you are listening to 91.7 FM, KPCW Park City.
Hi from NPR News in Washington. I'm Lakshmi Singh. The transition of power is complete. Moments ago, former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama left the U.S. Capitol for Maryland's Joint Base Andrews, where they will address their staff. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump saw them off, waving as a helicopter officially known as Executive One departed with the Obamas on board. The latest phase of a historic process.